Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane. Great to be with you. On my mind this week, the results of primary elections in four southern states and the historic nomination of Democrat Stacey Abrams for governor of Georgia. Is this more evidence that 2018 is proving to be the year of the woman? I ask Alexander Burns, national political correspondent for the New York Times.
The big picture of the primaries this week, and actually of really all the recent primaries, has been the degree to which women are really thriving as candidates on the Democratic side.
Then, on Twitter this week, President Trump has been attacking the former director of national intelligence, James Clapper. The president claims the FBI spied on his campaign. I talked to Clapper about those attacks and why he believes Russia's interference in the 2016 election changed the results.
It stretches logic and credulity to think that it didn't have effect. I think it did have a serious effect, and that's why I am so concerned about the profound threat Russia poses to our very system.
First, Alexander Burns, national political correspondent for the New York Times. Alexander Burns, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You know, Alex, I love election days and primary nights when voters actually get to tell us what they're thinking about, what's important to them. Tell us about what you thought from the primary night we had this week. We had primaries in Arkansas, Georgia, Kentucky, and runoffs in Texas. What struck you?
Well, there were a couple of sort of marquee primaries that we can sort of drill down on if you want. But I think the big picture of the primaries this week, and actually of really all the recent primaries, has been the degree to which women are really thriving as candidates on the Democratic side, that almost every opportunity where Democratic primary voters have the option to nominate a woman for Congress, they're taking that option. We can talk about the exceptions, too. But, you know, you had this really striking primary in central Kentucky where you had the DCCC go out and recruit the very popular mayor of Lexington, second biggest city in the state, to run for Congress. And he just got really run off the road by a political newcomer, a woman named Amy McGrath, a former Marine fighter pilot, who just on the strength of her biography and really this mood of looking for political outsiders, looking for women, just took control of the race.
You know, that was an interesting race, turned out not to be close. Amy McGrath has never run for office before. She had one terrific ad that talked about her groundbreaking status as a Marine fighter pilot.
When I was 12 years old, I knew exactly what I wanted to do when I grew up. I wanted to fly fighter jets and land on aircraft carriers because that's the toughest flying you can do.
And it was just really compelling. People are already saying, you know, you don't want to get ahead of yourself, but that she might have a really bright political future.
No, and I mean, we may not want to get ahead of ourselves, but Democrats in Kentucky are certainly already looking to that 2020 Senate race when Mitch McConnell would be up for, you know, yet another term if he decides to run for re-election. That Amy McGrath is the kind of person who you could see, based on the limited sort of real-time performance that we've seen so far, the kind of person who could be a powerful statewide candidate. And it's interesting, Susan, that in a lot of these races, you do see Democrats voting for women. You don't necessarily see the most liberal candidate in the race winning. That, you know, we've written a lot about the sort of emboldened left, the power of grassroots energy on the Democratic side, and all of that is true. But it does seem like right now identity more than ideology is shaping a lot of these races.
Now she's going to face a Republican incumbent, Andy Barr. How does that look in the general election?
Look, this is a tough race for the Democrats, but it is a competitive race this year in a way that it certainly wasn't 2 years ago or 2 years before that. Interestingly, when Jim Gray, the man who Amy McGrath defeated in the primary, he ran for Senate in 2016 against Rand Paul, Mayor Gray carried the 6th district in a statewide election. So this is a district that does vote Democratic sometimes and in certain circumstances. We just don't know whether this year is one of those circumstances. I can tell you, you know, having spoken to folks in Kentucky, folks who are close to Andy Barr, they're concerned about this race. And they think McGrath is a tougher opponent than Gray would have been because she just doesn't have a political record. That, you know, when you're running against a longtime mayor, you can go and look at his management of the city. You can look look at financial decisions he's made. You can look at crime rates and all kinds of material like that. When you're looking at somebody who's never been on a ballot before, let alone served in political office, it is tougher to find avenues for attack.
You know, another groundbreaking candidate in Georgia in the governor's race, Stacey Abrams, won the Democratic nomination, and she had gotten a lot of attention because she did not take the path in terms of looking at voter coalitions that a lot of Democrats in southern states have taken. What did she do?
So Stacey Abrams is a striking candidate, an important candidate for a lot of reasons. She is the first black woman ever nominated for governor of any state, and the first black candidate ever nominated for governor of Georgia, male or female. So her campaign is going to be a really compelling one to watch this fall. And part of it is, as you just alluded to, her theory of the case for how a Democrat competes in Georgia is really, really different from the sort of conventional wisdom that you need to practice, you know, what Democrats there have typically done. We saw them do this in the 2014 elections in Georgia for governor and Senate, is practice a really kind of defensive politics to nominate candidates who are, first of all, white, and second, who don't have ideological or cultural views that put them greatly at odds with rural voters, conservative-leaning white voters who not that long ago voted for Democrats like Sam Nunn and Zell Miller. That's not the approach Stacey Abrams is taking. The state has changed a lot. The sort of population of the white population in Georgia is down to about 53-54% of the state, although they tend to vote at higher rates. Georgia is on track to become majority-minority within the next decade. And so the Abrams theory of the case, and we've never seen it tested before, so we're not in a position really at this point to assess how viable it is that, you know, don't spend so much time going after those conservative-leaning rural whites. Don't spend a lot of time trying to play on nostalgia for, you know, the days of Jimmy Carter. Put a candidate up there who is going to get young people, black voters, Hispanic voters, Asian-American voters, younger women especially, get people to register to vote and then actually show up in force in a way that they have not in past midterm and presidential elections. So it's a daring strategy. It's a risky strategy. It's one that Democrats in Georgia and nationally are really not sure about, but they're pretty excited to see where it goes because it has implications for 2020 and beyond.
You know, do you think, Alex, you've covered politics for a while. Do you think it is surprising that in 2018, it's the first time any African-American woman anywhere in the country has been nominated for governor by a major party?
Personally, I do find it surprising. And I also find it, I think it's sort of in some ways pleasantly surprising how many people are surprised, if that makes sense, that, you know, not that long ago, it was seen as, you know, risky just in sort of clinical political terms that you would have Democratic strategists just sort of resist putting up, you know, non-white candidates in competitive elections in difficult states. The assumption was that, you know, of course a Democrat, you know, of course a black Democrat can't win a racially polarized southern state, right? In fact, a lot of skepticism that a black Democrat could win non-southern states. So the fact that we're now at a place in our political culture where so many people hear that this is a glass ceiling that's been broken, and they're surprised that it was even intact, it does say something, I think, about the political system sort of lagging cultural changes and sort of people's willingness to accept and embrace diversity.
Yeah, you know, we've had a lot more women presidents on TV than we have in the actual Oval Office. That'd be another example.
Right.
You know, it's been 16 years, I think, since Georgia elected a Democrat to be governor. So how does the general election look for Stacey Abrams?
Well, we'll have a better sense of that in July when we know who her Republican opponent is. You know, one of the real assets that Abrams has at this point is that, you know, she didn't just win the primary. She blew it out in the primary. She got more than 7 in 10 Democratic voters against a very credible primary opponent, another former state legislator also named Stacey. Republicans had a more fractured race, and so you now have a runoff in July between the sitting Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle, sitting Georgia Secretary of State Brian Kemp, both of whom are quite conservative and both of whom have really tried to position themselves in the Trump mode. So you know, Stacey Abrams now has a little bit of a head start to start raising money, start putting together an operation. I can tell you, you know, national Republicans do feel that at the end of the day, you know, Abrams is a candidate worth taking seriously, but they're very skeptical that a candidate who adopts, you know, a largely quite liberal policy agenda can win a state that really has no history of voting for Democrats with that ideological profile.
You know, we've seen a lot of speculation about the divide in the Democratic Party between Hillary Clinton or establishment Democrats and Democrats who aligned themselves with Bernie Sanders in the 2016 primary campaign. But, you know, the Bernie Sanders group, Our Revolution, has not shown much muscle in the primaries we've seen so far. What have you seen happen with that?
It's really true, and it's really striking. And, you know, I think the positive spin that the Sanders folks have put on it, and candidly, Susan, I don't think they're wrong, is that the sort of bigger picture of the Democratic Party is that candidates across the board have moved to the left, have moved towards Sanders-backed positions on health care, on education, on taxes, and more, so that you do have people winning primaries who are perceived as the establishment Democratic candidate, who are way more liberal than the establishment Democratic candidate would have been 8 or 12 years ago. But having said that, you know, it's one thing to shape the larger ideological conversation in a party, and Sanders has clearly done that. It's another thing to get involved in specific primary elections and shape outcomes and help your political allies. And Sanders has really no particular record of doing that at this point. He got involved in a big primary for governor of Virginia last year, backed the more liberal candidate or the more sort of explicitly liberal candidate in the Democratic primary. That candidate, Tom Perriello, got totally clobbered in the primary. Sanders has backed a number, or Our Revolution, which is sort of, it's tied to Sanders, but Sanders doesn't personally supervise it for legal reasons. Backed Dennis Kucinich in a primary for governor of Ohio. Backed this candidate, Laura Moser, a very liberal sort of activist journalist in a congressional primary in Texas. Didn't even get close, right? So they're going to point, you know, the Our Revolution folks point to races like the Georgia primary, where they endorsed Stacey Abrams, but everybody basically endorsed Stacey Abrams, right? So I don't know how much that counts for in a win-loss record. And it does point to the sort of, you know, limitations of the Sanders operation as a political machine, as an electioneering machine that can be counted on to deliver votes.
Yeah, that's true. But I can see the argument that they make that they're losing the battle, but they've won the war for the nature of the Democratic Party this year.
Right. And sort of in the bigger picture, that probably is more important that, you know, is it more important to hand pick a couple candidates for the House of Representatives to advance to the general election, or to make sure that, you know, virtually every Democrat who's considering running for president in 2020 is in favor of one or another massive expansion of government guaranteed health care, right? The second one is clearly the more consequential achievement, but in the short term, they're taking quite a bit of, you know, they're taking quite a few losses.
So let's talk about Donald Trump's role in these primaries. First, for Democrats, is it what are Democrats doing when it comes to talking about President Trump in these elections?
Well, it varies widely by state and district, because when you're looking at some of the more blue state primaries, which we really didn't see this last week, you know, but if you look at primary for governor of New York or primary for governor of California, it's a contest to see who can throw the hardest punch in the direction of the White House, and some candidates are being pretty creative in doing that. When you look at, you know, we were talking before about the Amy McGrath race. You know, some of these candidates don't talk all that much about President Trump because they know they need to win voters who voted for President Trump. And even if, you know, there is this sense in red states that even if people who voted for the president now have some misgivings about having done that, you don't really want to rub it in their face, right? So in Arkansas. Democrats nominated the rare male congressional candidate in a competitive race. Clark Tucker, this up-and-coming state legislator, nominated to challenge Republican Congressman French Hill in a Little Rock-based district. You know, Tucker barely talks about Trump on the road because he knows that if it's just a referendum on the president, he will probably lose in that district. And this is part of why Stacey Abrams, by the way, is a sort of a standout candidate. She does throw heat in the direction of the president. I saw her on the trail. It was about a year ago now at an event you know, south of Atlanta, talking about how you know she would never be shy about standing up to the president. And this is the word she used, the president or the fascists who advise him. Right. So that's very hot language for a Georgia Democrat.
Yeah, we should note that all four of these states that had contests on Tuesday were carried by Donald Trump in 2016. How about Trump's role on the Republican side? Are Republican candidates talking about the president?
They certainly are. I mean, they're talking about him in primaries, sometimes in very theatrical ways, you know, making claims that only I am the candidate in this race who was truly with Trump when he needed me in the 2016 election. Some of them are fudging the facts in order to sort of make that boast of loyalty. And then, you know, in these red states, you see Republicans already using the president in the general election, that especially in congressional races, in places like Arkansas, in places like Kentucky, where the president is, you know, not overwhelmingly popular, but basically in decent political shape, you have Republican members of Congress who are out there saying, you know, at the end of the day, this race is about whether the people of this district want someone who will be with the president or against the president, right? And that you know, that argument probably isn't powerful enough to keep the House in Republican hands, but it would be enough, probably, even in a Democratic wave year, to limit Republican losses in conservative-leaning places.
You know, it's interesting, Alex. I've heard some Republican office holders criticize President Trump, but they're almost invariably people who are not running for re-election this time, who are either retiring or aren't up this year. Are you aware of any significant Republican candidate who, in fact, is being critical publicly of President Trump?
A candidate who's running for re-election.
Who's running this year, yeah.
Only the exceptions that prove the rule that you just spelled out were it's a couple blue state Republican governors. So, you know, Charlie Baker in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. Larry Hogan in Maryland. These are guys who won states that just on paper have no business having a Republican governor, and where the president is not just unpopular but toxic. And you do see folks like them explicitly distancing themselves from the president. But no, I think overwhelmingly, you know, the rule, even someone like Mitt Romney, who when he was not a candidate was very blunt about criticizing President Trump, is being careful to avoid doing that to the greatest extent possible now that he's running for Senate in a state like Utah, where Trump won easily.
Alex Burns, you've been writing about this wave of teacher strikes and some interesting political consequences or repercussions from that that you've also written about. One happened in Kentucky this week. Talk about that race.
Sure. You know, those of us who focus mainly on federal politics, we're following that congressional primary most closely, the one we've been discussing. But for folks in Kentucky, the sort of oh my God moment of the night was when the Republican leader in the Kentucky House of Representatives, a 30-year-old rising star named Jonathan Schell, was defeated in a Republican primary by a math teacher who had never run for political office before. And this was a guy who, the math teacher that is, who in the middle of a standoff between Republican legislators and the governor and teachers over public pensions and school funding, this guy was one of several dozen teachers who decided to run for the legislature and really just came out of nowhere and upset this young man who was seen as a future potential governor of Kentucky. This is a staggering moment in state politics. And if you talk to Republicans in a state like Kentucky or in other states where you've seen these teacher strikes, teacher walkouts like Arizona, West Virginia, North Carolina, Oklahoma, there is a real concern that Republicans have maybe overplayed their hand in slashing state funding to services that voters fundamentally like. It's not that, you know, the race that we're talking about right now, this was a Republican primary, so it doesn't mean that you're going to suddenly see Democrats take charge in these states. But it does mean that Republicans who have been in charge may have to fight a lot harder just to keep control of their own party.
You know, every time we do polling at USA Today and ask people the issue that's most important to them, it's usually health care or education at the top of the list. We should keep that in mind in our coverage. So, Alex, let me just ask you a yes or no question. It's pretty simple. Will Democrats win control of the House in November?
You know, after 2016, I'm not going to fall for that one again. But look, what I would say is, as of today, if you were to administer a polygraph to all the leaders of both parties in both chambers of Congress, I think virtually all of them would bet that the House is going to flip to the Democrats. Not to say that it's a certainty, but that much more likely than not, the current thinking among party leaders on both sides is that Republicans will lose the House, and that the real battle, you know, that yes, we're going to be talking about the House in September, October, but the much more sort of tenuous battle for Republicans is really the Senate.
You know, I think one thing that I think you're absolutely right. Washington now assumes the House flips, but we are seeing some signs that that have been encouraging to Republicans. And if Democrats do not win control of the House, it seems to me that election night, however good it may be, is not going to look like a success to them.
I think that's totally true, you know, especially under, you know, the president has given them virtually every opening that they could have asked for in order to run the tables in the fall. And you know, Democrats will point, they point today to just the reality that the map is quite gerrymandered against them and that Republicans have an enormous amount of money at their disposal. That's all true. But, you know, a month ago, 2 months ago, Republicans were in a state of really total despair, and they're still pessimistic, but they think they've got a fighting chance now.
Do you think it's possible that Democrats win control of the Senate?
I think it's possible. You can talk yourself into the scenario where that happens, but it's very, very difficult. You know, they would need to, you know, not just pick up, you know, they would need to pick up two seats. So presumably the first two Republican-held seats that Democrats would win would be Nevada and then Arizona. But even if they were to then pick up a third seat, probably Tennessee, the seat that Bob Corker is vacating, then they still need to almost completely run the table on the enormous number of seats that they're defending in states that the president won and won by enormous margins, places like West Virginia, Missouri, North Dakota, Montana. So, you know, I think it's possible on a very, very good night for Democrats, but it would take a very, very, very good night.
We'll be watching. Alex Burns, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. James Clapper was director of national intelligence from 2010 to 2017. His new book is Facts and Fears, Hard Truths from a Life in Intelligence. James Clapper, it's so great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
You have spent your life in intelligence gathering at the Air Force, at the Defense Intelligence Agency, 6.5 years as director of national intelligence, the longest stint anyone has ever served in that very difficult role. Thank you for your service.
Well, thank you.
You have written a new book. It's called Facts and Fears, Hard Truths from a Life in Intelligence. And you begin and end your book with pretty dire assessments of Russia interference in the 2016 presidential election. Indeed, you have concluded that Russian interference changed the results of the 2016 election. How so?
Well, first, I should point out, Susan, that when we rendered our intelligence community assessment on the 6th of January 2017, we did not make any pronouncement about the impact on the election by virtue of the Russian interference. The only thing we did say that related to that was we saw no evidence of meddling with voter tallies. Not that there wasn't any, we just didn't see any evidence of it. The reason for that, of course, is that the Intelligence Committee is not chartered, didn't have the authority nor the capability to assess something domestically. But as a private citizen and knowing what we've learned since the publication of that Intelligence Community assessment, and I recount this in the book about the parallelism between the Trump campaign and the Russians in terms of what they were doing and saying, particularly in marginalizing Hillary Clinton as a candidate. When you consider that, you know, the election turned on about 80,000 votes in three key states, and when you consider the massive multidimensional effort that the Russians made, particularly using social media, which, you know, was exposed to millions and millions of voters, that to me, as I say in the book, it stretches logic and credulity to think that it didn't have effect. I think it did have serious effect, and that's why I am so concerned, above all else, about the serious, the profound threat Russia poses to our very system. This, and I should also add that this is not in any way a criticism or indictment of anyone who voted for President Trump. What it is an indictment of, and I hope a clarion call here, is the Russians and their attempts to fundamentally undermine our system.
You've concluded, is this correct, not just that there was an effect of the Russian meddling, but that it swung the election.
Well, I think it would, their involvement clearly had to. I mean, to say that it had no effect, to me, again, stretches logic. Now, I have to say, I don't have empirical evidence of this. You know, I've not gone out and done a voter survey. This is just my informed opinion based on what I knew before I left the government and what has been revealed since, particularly about the use of social media.
You're a student of history. Has this ever happened before in our American democracy?
Not to my knowledge, although there's a long history of Russians interfering in elections, theirs and other people's, and there is in this country, going back at least to the 60s. We have records of, in various ways, the Russians trying to interfere and influence elections, but never as direct, aggressive, and as multifaceted as the presidential election of 2016.
And the intelligence agencies of the United States government, of course, accustomed to looking for Russian action on various fronts, including the election, but you think slow to realize just how extensive the Russian effort was going to be on this election.
Well, I can certainly say this for myself, that because I've been asked, what was the exact moment when you realized this was something much different, profoundly different? And I can't point to an exact moment in time. This occurred for me gradually over the summer and into the fall of 2016. And I've seen a lot of bad stuff in my 50 years in intelligence. But this viscerally, physically, made me ill when I realized the magnitude of it and how it was being centrally orchestrated. It was very disturbing. And that, in turn, was the major motivation for writing the book.
It also motivated you not just to write your book, Facts and Fears, now, but to decide to try to speak out during the election in a way that is really not familiar to someone in your position.
Well, I didn't speak out at all until after I left the government on the 20th of January. And initially, I actually started with a phone call to then-President-elect Trump on the 11th of January, 9 days before I left. And my initial impulse was to simply defend the men and women of the intelligence community. When we were called Nazis. And so I sort of backed into, becoming more of a voice than I had ever anticipated, and as someone who's pretty much worked in the shadows and tried to stay anonymous, which I was able to do for most of my career except for the DNI time. It's an unlikely role for me.
Now, you do have the president's attention. That's clear on Wednesday morning as you began the publicity tour for your new book. He tweeted that you were the world's dumbest former intelligence head. What'd you think of that tweet?
Well, at least I excelled at something. You know, I was asked once in an interview how a previous negative tweet, critical tweet I got from President Trump and how did I feel about it. And I said, well, it really didn't bother me very much. And that in itself is kind of a sad commentary.
You know, you think about the relationship that President Trump has with the intelligence agencies who exist to serve him, to provide him information to make decisions. How would you characterize that relationship today?
Well, I think it's probably better than it was during the transition, because now he has leaders installed that are his team that he has faith, I presume, has faith, trust, and confidence in. For example, Gina Haspel, who was recently sworn in as director of CIA. When I called him on the 11th, though, I tried to make that point. I said, you know, that basically, you're, Mr. President-elect, you're inheriting a national treasure in the form of the intelligence community. And you have thousands of dedicated men and women, many of whom are in very risky situations, who are trying to protect this country and make it safe and secure, and they are committed to providing you as much timely, accurate, relevant, anticipatory intelligence that they can possibly muster. And I would hope, I wrote him a note that said earlier when he got his first presidential daily briefing, that I hope he would abide by the time-honored motto of truth to power from his intelligence community, not only expect it, but protect that. I'm not sure that message resonated with him. But I think it's probably better. I don't think the intelligence community is so much under the gun as much as the law enforcement community, which I find disturbing.
Did he respond to your note?
The note, to distinguish that from the phone call that was later, he did thank me profusely for it. In fact, three times during the course of the briefing that we gave on the 6th of January at Trump Tower.
You know, that was an important meeting, a meeting that's been written about quite a bit,
yeah.
Including from another book out recently, the James Comey book. You were among these four heads of intelligence agencies who went and met with the president-elect. At that point, what did you take away about President-elect Trump at that meeting?
Well, first of all, it was actually very, very cordial. We were, I think, a bit apprehensive because we weren't sure how he would react, particularly given a pretty critical tweet that he put out about the scheduling, which was that was set in concrete. We had to brief President Obama first because it was he who asked for the report to start with. So, but it was generally, I think, cordial and professional, and he listened, pushed back on some things. I will say, though, that one thing that was evident to me, at least, that it was very difficult for him to accept any information that would somehow cast doubt on the legitimacy of his election. And I think that has sustained to this day, and I think that's one of the reasons why he has issues with the intelligence community.
You mentioned that the president is now being very critical of the law enforcement community, not specifically the intelligence community, but that relates to his assertion that the FBI improperly used an informant who reached out to members of his campaign during the campaign. Does he have a legitimate beef there? Was there anything inappropriate going on by the FBI?
Well, if you ask me, no. I think it was appropriate. I would also say that I contemporaneously did not know about this informant, nor would I know or any DNI know about specific informants that the FBI uses. This is it's a legitimate way to glean information. The FBI uses a lot of informants that make valuable contributions to both intelligence and law enforcement. And I think the point that gets missed here, and I think perhaps deliberately by the president, is this is not about spying on his campaign. This is about determining what the Russians were up to. Were they attempting to infiltrate and gain access, gain influence, whatever, to the campaign? So I would argue that what they were trying to do was to actually protect our political system by using an informant. And whether it was his campaign or anybody else's campaign, because this was about the Russians, which is the focus, the target, not campaigns per se.
You know, the name of this informant has now been widely publicized, although not every news organization is choosing to use it. Will this have an effect, do you think, on efforts to recruit informants down the road? Or do you think it's just one of those things that'll be seen as kind of a one-off controversy?
Well, potentially it could be very chilling, not only for informants, who some of whom have been doing this for many years, but they do so with the promise of confidentiality and the protection of their identity. So I think perhaps some of them are thinking twice about a continued relationship with the FBI if they're going to be outed. And I think it would potentially have a very chilling effect on future informants who may want to come forth and cooperate with the FBI. And that's a loss of potentially valuable information and, in a sense, could make the country less safe and secure.
We've had a big dispute here in town in Washington about whether House Republicans are able to get some of this information from the Justice Department about exactly how that worked. And the Justice Department has now agreed to let congressional Republicans see some of these classified documents. Is that the right thing to do, do you think?
No, I don't. I think this is a further erosion of the independence of the Department of Justice and the FBI. And I think it's not good for the country when the president appears to have violated a longstanding norm to protect and sustain the independence, even though it might make them uncomfortable. But that is a time-honored principle, a tenet of our system of government. And I think it, long-term, it could be the beginning of a slippery slope. It's clear that there's a conscious effort to undermine the investigation and by the special counsel. So I think under the circumstances, that was a perhaps Solomon-like compromise to agree to refer the allegation to the Inspector General. But I just think the president involving himself in an investigation is not a good thing.
You say it might be the beginning of a slippery slope. Where does that slippery slope end? Where does that slippery slope
end? Well, I don't know, but where one way it could end, I suppose, is in firing the Deputy Attorney General and ending the Mueller investigation. That's one path down a slippery slope, but I don't know that it'll go that way.
In your mind, would that be a kind of crisis of government?
I think it would. I think it would be. I was around during the Watergate. I was in the intelligence community then, and I never felt at the time that our institutions were in jeopardy, and I do now.
This feels like a perilous time to you.
It does. It feels very different than the obvious historical parallel of Watergate.
Let's step back just a bit to the campaign. A month before the election, you and Jay Johnson, who was then Homeland Security Secretary, released a joint statement that talked about Russian interference. What effect did you think that statement would have?
Jay and I particularly felt strongly that we owed it to the electorate to issue some form of warning because of what we knew. And there was a lot of debate about whether that was a good thing to do. If we made some big pronouncement, or the President Obama made a speech about it, well, would that only serve to amplify or magnify what the Russians were doing? And I think the president was understandably concerned about the appearance or the optic of putting his hand on the scale in favor of one candidate and to the disfavor of another. So that was it. We had a lot of debate and discussion about that. But in the end, it was agreed that Jay and I would jointly issue a statement that laid out what the Russians were doing, because we felt, and this was, we issued this on the 7th of October of 2016, about a month before the election. Unfortunately, that was the same day as the Access Hollywood tapes, audio tapes came out. So our message was completely emasculated, and I don't think had much impact.
You know, hindsight is 20/20. With the benefit of hindsight, is there something you wish you had done then?
Well, I think one thing I personally wish is that we had imposed sanctions and PNG'd 35 Russian intelligence operatives and closed the two Dachas before the election. As it was, we didn't do it till the 29th of December. And even then, I consider that just sort of phase one of what I thought other steps that should be taken to cause Russia pain for doing what they did.
A lot of Democrats think President Obama should have done more. Do you think he should have done more?
Well, that's the aforementioned debate and what I think constrained him. And I think that was a valid concern. You have to recall the very charged partisan environment of the election. And I think, and of course, candidate Trump was already alleging that the election would be rigged against him. And so he was very mindful of that and was actually trying not to make it worse. With the benefit of 2020 hindsight, which is always perfect, well, you can do coulda, woulda, shouldas all day long.
Do you think the
administration did do some things. For one thing, that President Obama did, unlike our current president, is he directly and pretty stiffly confronted Putin about it. And President Trump seems to accept Putin's word that, you know, they didn't meddle, you know, over what his own intelligence community said.
In the middle of the night when you can't sleep, do you do coulda, woulda, shouldas on this?
To be honest, no, I don't. I sleep a lot better now than I have since the 20th of January of last year.
That's because that was your last day on the job?
Exactly.
We look back. Let's look ahead. When you think about the election, the midterm election that's coming up just in November, this fall, do you think there will be Russian interference?
I think so. I think they will. I think they will. They will look for ways, you know, and some may be new techniques, but they will look for ways to interfere and try to influence elections. Yes, they will.
And in 2020?
It's in their genes to do it.
In 2020, the next presidential election, will they take lessons learned from 2016 and apply them?
Absolutely. I think they've already taken lessons learned and, you know, what they can get away with and what they can't. And I think what will happen is that what they do will be harder to detect.
What should we do about that?
Well, that's a great question. Apart from doing the, I think, the common sense things with respect to securing what I would call the voting apparatus, voter registration rolls, you know, tally machines, whatever, all that, the hard part here, and that's another motivation for writing the book, was, you know, my little attempt to try to educate the public about the threat posed by the Russians, because in the end, that's what it's going to take is a vigilant and alert electorate who, where there is a willingness to question where information comes from, where ads, who is financing ads, and what is the source of information that they are reading or hearing. Now, that's hard to get that across to people. Regrettably, the United States is a very ripe target for the Russians to exploit our divisiveness, the polarization in this country, and they'll continue to do that.
And in fact, even with books like your own, news articles that try to explore what happened in 2016 and since then, there's a big partisan divide in whether Americans believe it or think it's serious. Republicans are much more likely to think the president's right and it's a muddle and it's a witch hunt, and Democrats much more likely to say it's a terrible thing that we really need to address.
Right, and so the very issue of Russian interference has itself become a political issue, and which is regrettable. I was very struck by the evidence that we turned up. The evidence, which I can't discuss, we had very high confidence in and was very compelling of what they did. So knowing that, it's hard for me to ignore it.
I want to talk about one other topic, which is North Korea. Now, you're clearly pretty critical of President Trump on some things. But on North Korea, what do you think about the steps he's taken toward holding this summit with the North Korean leader?
Well, I know there are downsides to agreeing to meeting with Kim Jong-un, which on the North Korean perspective is a huge concession on the part of the United States. That's something that leaders, Kim Jong-un's father and grandfather, sought, is a meeting with the President of the United States, whoever it was. So just the fact that he agreed to that is a big deal for the North Koreans. They crave that recognition. They want to be seen as equals. That said, though, I do think that, you know, we've been stuck on our narrative and the North Koreans have been stuck on theirs, that this could maybe shake the trees. I think, though, the credit, if there is credit, and if this meeting actually happens, should much more appropriately go to President Moon of the Republic of Korea, South Korea, who has orchestrated this summit, the meetings, with the dialogue with Kim Jong-un, which in my view is a good thing. And so he's managed his account in Pyongyang and his account in Washington pretty well. And I think his visit here was to try to jumpstart the momentum, the diplomatic momentum. But I think this administration is getting a taste of what all previous administrations have encountered in dealing with North Korea. They are prickly, sensitive, paranoid, and unpredictable.
The U.S. position has been that North Korea should not be allowed to have a nuclear weapons capability. Is it now more realistic for the United States to try to make small incremental steps that might go to containment rather than to denial?
Well, a couple points here. When I went to North Korea in November 2014, I was armed with coordinated talking points of the administration, the first one of which was, you must denuclearize before we'll talk to you. Well, I quickly learned that as a non-starter. You know, the North Koreans brought up what's become known as the Libyan model. They went to school on Muammar Gaddafi, who negotiated away his weapons of mass destruction. And the outcome wasn't so good for him. And the North Koreans, they see that. They're pretty astute. They watch that stuff. So the notion of denuclearizing simply because we say so, I think, is unlikely without a long and protracted set of negotiations. I could be wrong. It could surprise me. We get miracles, hope springs eternal, but I don't think so. North Koreans made a long effort, and they sacrificed a lot. The North Korean people sacrificed a lot to achieve what they have now. And I think that's really, in my view, is what prompted this change in behavior, is because the North Koreans achieved whatever it is they think they needed to in the way of a nuclear deterrent. And I find it hard to believe that they're just going to give it away because we demand that they do so. And by the way, denuclearization could be a two-way street. We need to be careful what we ask for here, because the North Koreans, and I wonder if the Chinese haven't counseled the North Koreans about this, could say that denuclearization applies both ways, meaning the United States doesn't fly any more bombers, B-1s, B-2s, B-52s, to the Korean Peninsula or in operational proximity to it. Meaning they would want us to agree to restrict our nuclear umbrella, which, of course, has covered the Republic of Korea and, in fact, the region for decades. So when we say denuclearize the peninsula, that could have two-way application.
James Clapper, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's all for this week. We'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851. And go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden and comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Doug Bell and Natalie Yurov-Lifker. Thanks for listening. I'm Susan Page.